Good morning, everybody. This is Frank Moreno on Talk Radio 107.1 FM. Good news, great news, especially for all of you out there on Eastern Long Island, and even better news for all of you that are not on Eastern Long Island. We finally, after months and months of doing this show, we finally have a brand new Talk Radio 107.1 app. It will allow you to listen live to all of the shows on this station, including this one, and it'll allow you to hear the podcasts of all the shows on this station. So if you're listening to this on the radio and you have a smartphone, I want you to right now stop what you're doing, especially if you're in your car, pull over, stop what you're doing and download the Talk Radio 107.1 FM app. Just go to app and just go to wherever you get your apps, your Google Play Store or your App Store, and just, it's free. Just type in Talk Radio 107.1 or WLIR, and it will come up. Now, it is 2 weeks from today that we have Election Day. Now, Michael Smirkanish, who's one of the TV commentators and radio commentators that I really like listening to the most, he has said, and I think he's right, that we should not call the day that happens 2 weeks from now Election Day. We should call it the final day of voting because millions of people are going to be voting between now and Election Day. That includes me. I'm going to be voting early. And the first day that we can vote early, I am going to be running to vote early and cast my ballot. Now, a ton of interesting things. We're going to get into a preview of the debate on Thursday with Jen Kearns. Jen Kearns is a radio talk show hostess. She's a Republican strategist. She's somebody that's actually been a writer for different presidential debates over the years. So I'm going to get her preview of the debate format and how it works for Donald Trump. Now, the big news is that there will be a mute button. They're going to be able to mute the candidates to stop the candidates from interrupting one another. So it'll be interesting to see how that whole thing plays out. And in just a minute, we're going to talk with Dr. Peter Mikolos, one of the finest physicians in the Hamptons, about what exactly is happening with the coronavirus. Now, just so everybody, my cards are on the table. This is a Long Island show. We try and do it local for Long Island. However, I'm not in Long Island or on Long Island. I'm in New York City or on New York City. So I'm doing the show from Manhattan. Now, part of the way that I try and stay attuned to what's going on in Long Island is I'll read all the local Long Island publications. I'll read Dan's Papers. You heard me talking with Todd Shapiro yesterday. I'll read 27 East. I'll read The Patch. And yeah, I'll read Newsday. And I got to say, I am so annoyed with Newsday because I used to be able to get all the headlines emailed directly to me every day in a newsletter type format. And I keep trying to sign up for this now that I have a new email address and I can't sign up for whatever reason. It's not letting me get there now. And keep in mind, my wife works for Newsday part time. And you'd think I'd have a little bit of juice because of her. But no, I have no juice. But what are you going to do? If you have any suggestions on how to beat the system with Newsday, please email me, frank.moreno@wabcradio.com. Meantime, while every aspect of life is still seemingly affected by the coronavirus, one of the things that can be frustrating for a lot of us is it seems very difficult to actually know where to go to get straight answers, where to go to get unbiased information, where to go to get information from people that don't have some sort of an agenda that they're pushing one way or another. Well, we've enjoyed on this program from time to time checking in with Dr. Peter Mikolos. He is one of the finest physicians in the Hamptons. He is one of the most sought after researchers and lecturers and has been for more than two decades. And he joins us again on the radio. Dr. Mikolos, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Frank, and good morning to your audience.
So first, let's talk about where we are with the prospect of a vaccine. There seems to be some concern about the efficacy level of a vaccine that the government will consider effective. Apparently, it's only going to be about 50% before the government says, okay, that's all right, we're okay with that. Do you think that's maybe an insufficient number before they start putting that out there before the public?
Well, I think that we need to have a vaccine that's safe, effective, and also reproducible in large quantities. I think one of the hints was a few, probably about 6 weeks ago, when the United Kingdom government pre-ordered 90 million vaccines from Pfizer, and the U.S. government ordered 100 million vaccines from Pfizer. And that was a kind of a hint that they weren't ordering their vaccines from their own country in the UK, but they were ordering the American Pfizer company vaccine. And the other hint was that the trials for the Pfizer vaccine went so well that they began testing it on 12-year-olds and up. And that's usually a sign that things went very well with the adult version of the vaccine. So in my opinion, as we've been talking about on the CATS Roundtable since late March, I thought that the partnership of Pfizer with the German company BioNTech was one of the best teams that was put together, and their vaccine seems to be the most promising of the American vaccines. And again, with all due respect to the Russians, you know, they don't have to deal with the FDA and the legal system and lawsuits. And they do have a vaccine that's out there and it's working in their population. And other countries are actually buying it, including India. And they named it Sputnik, sort of to rub it in, because Sputnik was the first satellite in space. And that's why their vaccine is named Sputnik. So, they, you know, there are vaccines. Again, vaccines will only protect a certain percentage of the population, just like the flu vaccine protects about 45% of the people who took it. So to get us out of the pandemic, vaccines are just one of the components of several. Like many other viral illnesses, including AIDS, it took a cocktail of three different antivirals to suppress the AIDS viral, for example. And just like we saw with the president, there was a cocktail approach where the virus was attacked on several fronts with an antibody.
I want to ask you a little bit about the president's treatment and what that portends for the treatment of other people that get the virus. But there were a whole bunch of articles coming out yesterday with the headline COVID-19 hospitalization rate and death toll rising. Have you seen these numbers, and do you believe that they're cause for concern?
Well, my understanding is that the number of cases will rise as we approach winter, but the death rate, as we have learned more about virus, I think the death rate will be dropping. Again, there are a lot of factors, a lot of pre-existing conditions that have greater risk factors. You know, we have an epidemic of obesity, for example, in the United States, and that's not helping us at all. So there are multiple factors, but I think overall that the death rate, will be dropping. You know, we will probably have more cases as winter approaches, as we enter indoor spaces. We're learning a lot more how temperature, humidity, and indoor spaces affects the spread of the virus. The data that came out of Kobe University in Japan showing that in humid weather at 60% humidity, the viral load in the air was half versus 30% humidity, where the viral load was double. And the fluid dynamics lab at MIT showed that it can go 26 feet with a good cough and a sneeze. And that's why mask wearing is important, mostly for the people who have it.
Just going back to the humidity issue for a second, though, would you suggest to people that might be high risk or people that have occasion to interact with people that may have the virus that they consider using a humidifier on a regular basis?
Oh, absolutely. I think that in homes, I think having a simple $10 digital hygrometer, which tells you the percent humidity. And when you see the humidity is falling below 60%, that you can turn on a humidifier. And I think that businesses, for a small investment, like I see all this money about spraying down the rooms and spraying down restaurants and businesses, that's only good for that particular moment. Mm. What I'm interested in is an ongoing program to keep the air sanitized using a combination of humidity, central humidity controls, combined with ultraviolet C lights that are inside the air handlers, and whether you have heat or air conditioning, to constantly zap, sanitize the air like they use in Florida and nursing homes. They use it for mold mitigation, but the side effect is in the central air conditioners, especially with shared rooms, that it's constantly also zapping and killing airborne viruses, mold, and bacteria. And, you know, UV light has been around a long time. It got the Nobel Prize in 1903 for killing skin infections before antibiotics. Mm. It was used to kill bacteria, viruses, and mold in water in Marseille, France in the 1900s. Before antibiotics, when you had an infection in your blood called sepsis, that's how they used to kill it. They let the blood draw out of one vein and basically a glass jar in a dark box, zap it with UV light, and then put it back in your other arm. And that was called extracorporeal UV sanitizing of the blood. And then something called antibiotics came along and you didn't need it anymore. So UV has a long history. So controlling the UV and the humidity in restaurants, movies, theaters, grocery stores, shopping, that will actually help reduce the amount of viral load in the air and transmission. And that's why sitting outside with lots of moving air helps. And that's why climates like in Africa, for example, many parts of Africa where it's hot and humid, the virus has a lot more trouble transmitting. And Florida, when you're outdoors, is fine. But when you're indoors in the air-conditioned spaces, that's where the transmission is happening, in the restaurants and the bars and in the closed spaces. So we need to pay more attention to the air quality.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Mikolos, longtime physician and medical analyst. You can, those of you that live in Southampton area might be familiar with him. Those of you listening to us online at WABCRadio.com may have heard his repeated appearances for the last few years on the Cats Roundtable. I always learn something new whenever I listen to them. I always learn something new whenever I talk to him. And Dr. Mikolos, you alluded to the treatment that the president got when he came out and he recovered, and thankfully he looks and sounds great. He was touting Regeneron. Did he also, in addition to this Regeneron, get standard antibody therapy?
Well, it's not about it's basically therapy is from Regeneron. It's a New York-based company invented by Greek-American physician George Yancopoulos, who basically made a mouse that mimics the human immune system. And they exposed, for example, a few years ago, the Ebola virus to it. They made antibodies. Antibodies are like little condoms that fit over the spike proteins, which are like little skeleton keys that enter our cells and infect them. They did the same thing and exposed this mouse that allowed antibodies to be formed against the coronavirus. And again, they infuse it into a patient. And that week that the president got it, earlier in the week, they announced they successfully had used it with no side effects on 275 people. So when you get that infusion before the virus gets a chance to even enter your cells, it goes around like little Pac-Man and condoms and covers the little spike protein so that it can't do anything and quickly incapacitates the virus. And it was successful in Ebola, and it has been successful, as we're seeing right now, with the president and other people. And because of the president's order called the Right to Try Act, anything in clinical trials that works out well, your physician and the patient has the right to apply to the company to be able to use it. So we're seeing that now we have the capacity to get access to these treatments. And, for example, the antiviral remdesivir is available in hospitals in the United States. The dexamethasone anti-inflammatory that was used on the president to stop the cytokine storm and lung inflammation is available and it is being used. And this is all helping to improve the mortality rate. For example, Christy, I'm sure, got the same cocktail, and he had many, many risk factors, and seems like he also did well and survived. So we've learned a lot more about the virus and how to treat it. And like many other viral illnesses, the cocktail approach will help. So it's going to be a combination of the antivirals, the antibodies, and the other treatments, including high flow nasal oxygen instead of ventilators, and a vaccine and herd immunity. And all these things will come together to get us through to the other side of this pandemic.
You know, your version of the founding of Regeneron is a little bit different from the one trumpeted by the New York Times the day after the president started touting it. The New York Times ran, I think, on its front page a big series of articles about how this was actually the product of things like stem cell research and research that the president and his party have opposed. Is the Times off base here in their chronicling of how Regeneron came to be?
No. For example, if you have a medicine and someone decides to test it against a cell line that may have originated 30 years ago from a stem cell, you know, that's a big, big stretch. And it's very deceptive. What actually happened was that this was a genetically engineered mouse that Dr. Yancopoulos did when he was a student back in the 80s. And then in 2013, they also got patents on the process of making antibodies from a mouse that basically mimics the immune system and had nothing to do with stem cells. So it's, for example, it's like if you invented a new, windshield wiper. And let's say somebody used your windshield wiper to clean something that was made from stem cells. They make that leap in association. But to actually make those antibodies, no, they are not stem cells. And they are basically part of nature where you've created this mouse with a human immune system. You make these antibodies, and that's why there's like no problems or side effects, because they're like ready-made antibodies instead of having to suffer and go through the infection and launch an entire immune response. You're getting instant ready-made to go antibodies, and it's quite amazing. And it's also what helped to get the Ebola crisis under control. And we're very grateful that in the New York tri-state area, all these great inventions have come out.
Absolutely. Dr. Mikolas, one of the things that we've seen is states like New Jersey, which were thought to have a good handle on the virus, we've seen a bit of an uptick there, an average of about 900 positive cases a day. Even in New York, which on the whole has done pretty well, we're seeing these so-called hot spots, many in the Orthodox Jewish community. At the same time, we're seeing some folks embrace a theory of herd immunity that just calls for allowing this virus to work its way through the population. Are you as concerned as some other public health experts that the embrace of herd immunity could lead to more people getting sick and more people dying?
Yeah, of course. Listen, it's a very tough situation. Nobody wants to be the one to say, okay, everyone get out there and catch it, because this thing is still dangerous. It does affect young people. You know, some countries have a different approach. For example, in Turkey, what they do, people 45 and under, everyone go out, go to work. The younger teachers go to school, open the schools. And then the teachers who are over 45, they're the ones who stay home and do the Zoom and online learning. And they try to get people out. Otherwise, you're going to suffer an econocide, which is a destruction of your economy. So there, you know, nobody wants to be the person to put their name on it. So I think it's a balanced, common sense approach where you do have to open things, you know, up carefully, be respectful. And, you know, I do believe in masks. I do believe in social distancing, washing hands, creating environments with proper humidity and temperature. And that's why the air quality is better and people get sick less. So we have to pay more attention to our air sanitization in the schools and we have to try to start to open up, and we have to be smart about it. But yes, there will be some losses, and it could be any of us. You know, I worry about this every day. No, I don't really want to get it, even though we've come a long way, because it seems to be, you know, a pretty nasty infection to get. And even post-COVID, you know, I know people who were in their 40s, a prominent physician in New York, was on a ventilator for 10 days and now has, you know, become an oxygen cripple. There's going to be a whole bunch of, you know, disabled people after this. And some people are coming out of it with a brain fog type of syndrome. So there are problems, weird things like hair loss and, you know, long-term loss of smell. So it's not, you know, it's not a benign condition. So we still have to be respectful and not be cavalier. And like with anything else, that's we don't know everything about it yet. We just have to be, you know, respectful, but we do have to open up, because I'm, you know, hearing about people who are, you know, suicidal, opioid addiction is up. You know, a lot of people are on antidepressants, and I talk to people who tell me how they've had to double up on their antidepressants. And, you know, it's just finding that balance. But yes, herd immunity will help a lot of these young people, and also knowing and the testing is very important. When you have a community that has a lot of testing, those people who are tested, we know who has it. So we can tell those people to quarantine for 14 days and not spread it to the older crowd.
My final question, Dr. Peter Mikolas, you alluded to the situation in schools. One bright spot in terms of the fight against this virus came out of New York City yesterday. 10,676 tests yielded just 18 positive results. Do you think this is an indication that the steps that the Department of Education officials are taking are working to stop the spread of the virus? Or is this a reflection of the fact that kids are just less likely to get it? Or is it a little bit of both?
No, I think it's a combination of both. I think that, remember, the virus isn't what is killing people. It's our extreme immune response against the virus that results in our own body attacking the virus, which causes all the inflammation throughout the body, and that causes the fluid in the lungs, the cytokine storm, which is like drowning. The younger, more immature immune system may not recognize this as much of a threat and doesn't launch this overwhelming response. That's the reason why they use the steroid dexamethasone, which tells our own adult immune system, hey, relax, don't overreact to this virus, because you don't need to fill up the entire lung with fluid. Just calm down. And that's how sometimes steroids work in extreme inflammatory conditions. Mm-hmm. So it is a balancing act. And I think, you know, we do have to open up. And I think that historically, these pandemics last for about 16 to 18 months. If you look at, you know, 1890s and 1917, and people forget the 1968-69 Hong Kong flu, where 1 million people died worldwide, 100,000 in the United States, that, you know, these things do happen and they last around 18 months. So I suspect by next June we'll be coming out of it. And I think the vaccines that are going to be around and the antivirals and the antibody cocktails will all help us get out of this soon, so that we can move on with life and open up our economies, which are just waiting to bounce back like a rubber band.
That's for sure. Dr. Peter Mikolas, thanks as always for being so generous with your time. I'm sure we'll be calling upon your expertise again very soon.
Thank you, everyone. Be safe and be smart, and God bless America.
Amen. We'll continue on Talk Radio 107.1 FM. I'm Frank Moreno. This is Frank Moreno here on Talk Radio 107.1 and on WABCRadio.com. You can also catch me every morning if you're up bright and early. Actually, I guess at that hour, it's more dark and early on WABC, in addition to this station, from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And it is a real pleasure to welcome somebody that is one of my Los Angeles counterparts, although she's managed to negotiate slightly more human hours for herself. One of my absolute favorites, former spokesperson for the California Republican Party, longtime conservative pundit, Republican strategist, and the host of All American Radio, which can now be heard on Talk Radio 790 KABC, my good friend Jen Kearns. Jen, how are you?
Hey, Frank, doing well. You forgot New Yorker in exile. I'm just waiting to come back to New York, waiting for Governor Cuomo to fix me dinner, as he promised so many of us.
Well,
just outside of the city, waiting to come back in. I'm waiting for it.
I don't think either of us should be holding our breath, but I'll look forward to having you back when you are in town. So, first of all, congratulations again on joining the lineup of at KABC. Ever since internet streaming has been a thing, I have been hooked on KABC. Some of my favorites have been on that station. Doug McIntyre, Brian Whitman, a number of others go back a few more years. Folks like Dennis Prager and Bob Grant, certainly. People like Bill O'Reilly and Larry Elder. It's a terrific station with a terrific audience, and they're a little bit better now that they've added you. So congratulations and best of luck.
Thank you so much. You know, true story, my friends and I, when we first got involved in politics and first got interested in it post 9/11, we actually used to call into 790 KABC when we were just a part of the Orange County Young Republicans, you know, doing pro support the troop rallies, you know, to provide a counter voice to the crazies up in San Francisco. And we used to call into 790 KABC and hold on the line for an hour just to get 1 minute to talk to Larry Elder. And as soon as we made air, we would all cheer and everyone would erupt with cheers in the room. And so it's pretty amazing to be back on my, you know, home station of 790 KABC. So between you and I, we have KABC and WABC. We got both coasts covered.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's Al Rentel land. Al was certainly a fixture on KABC. All right. Enough of this tomfoolery, Jen. I want to take advantage of some of your expertise as somebody that has been a writer for the presidential debates. You know, I spoke to you, I believe it was the morning after the first Trump-Biden debate. Now they're going to be debating Thursday night. I understand they've actually added a mute button. Tell me what you're expecting in this debate from both candidates and from the sort of the show itself. What are you anticipating in this debate?
I'm expecting nothing differently than what Trump brought to the first debate. Here's why. The buzzer edition only applies to the first opening question of each round of topics. So it does not apply to the back and forth that the candidates may have during their discussion period of those topics. And so I do expect President Trump to still be right on the heels of Joe Biden in each of those questions. And the reason you can tell Joe Biden knows it too is he has put a lid on his campaign. He is taking, in essence, 3 days off in order to prepare for the next debate with President Trump. And so I think Biden knows what we know, which is President Trump sees this as his last ditch effort to sew up the election headed into the final week of the campaign. And I think that President Trump right now is, if I may say, has a perfect storm and has the wind at his back and the wind in his sails. Here's why. You have the Hunter Biden scandal breaking open, which here's why it's important. I don't think that most Americans care about what Hunter Biden did or his character, or if he's a drug dealer or a drug doer. They don't care about that. What they do care about is that Joe Biden for the last 18 months has been campaigning on one central theme. And that is that he's a decent guy. And he says, I'm the guy. I'm the guy. I'm the decent guy. I'm the guy that's going to keep your health care. I'm the guy that cares about seniors. I'm the guy. I'm the guy. He's not a decent guy. And these Hunter Biden emails prove it, because if Hunter Biden, as these emails appear to show, was really doing these huge business deals with foreign governments and foreign companies and giving his dad a cut of 10%, and in some cases up to 50%, as Hunter Biden referenced in these emails, then Joe Biden was lying about the key question he's been asked. It's the only tough question he's ever been asked on the campaign trail. And that is if he's ever had a conversation with his son, Hunter, about his dealings overseas. And he said no. It cuts at the heart of that question right there. It proves that Joe Biden's not the decent guy he claims to be. It proves that he's a swamp dweller, just like everybody else who has spent 47 years in Washington. And so even if that question, Frank, is not on the menu at this week's debate, believe me, President Trump will find a way to weave it into the narrative this Thursday.
What about the questions of the authenticity of these emails? You're now seeing the sort of the counter narrative to this story be that this has all the makings of a Russian counterintelligence operation. And Rudy Giuliani, my colleague here at Talk Radio 107.1, might have unwittingly been used as a pawn in some Russian propaganda operation. Where do you see that going, both on the merits and politically?
Breaking last night, the director of national intelligence, the DNI, Radcliffe, actually coming out and saying, no, there are actually records that show the FBI took this laptop into custody a year ago in December. Think about that. A year ago in December. This was right before the impeachment proceedings began against President Trump in earnest in January. So that is very damning to show that the FBI actually took custody of this and didn't bring this up once when questioning what the Trump kids were up to overseas, questioning what President Trump might have been up to overseas. Didn't once mention these Hunter Biden emails that they had full custody of. And those have signatures checking those in. There's an FBI sheet that's been released this evening. I'm not sure if it was by the DNI or by somebody else at the FBI, but that does show the chain of custody. You also have this computer store manager in Delaware. He actually reportedly made copies of the hard drive and gave them to a few friends because he feared that he would end up dead.
Wow.
Dead. And that tells you again, Joe Biden is not this perhaps decent guy that he claims he is. This guy was so terrified that he had stepped on the third rail. Apparently, when he was working on the hard drive, came across numerous instances.
In fairness to Joe Biden and, you know, the allegation of him possibly being a murderer, we can't speak to the paranoia of one guy that may fear that that he could end up dead. He doesn't necessarily have anything rational to fear. He's just saying that's how he felt. I mean, there's no implication at all or no there's no claim at all that Joe Biden or Hunter Biden actually threatened this guy, as far as we know at this point.
Correct. I only brought that up for this point, Frank, and that is that this is not a person that went to the National Enquirer to sell this. This is not a person who was seeking fame. This is not a person who went to Fox News and pitched themselves to be on TV. This is a guy who said, gosh, I came across several photos and numerous emails that and they haven't yet shared with us what this is, but he said of illegal activity that was in the photos as well as the emails, and that's why he came forward and apparently contacted the FBI. Now, I only bring that up because this isn't a guy that was a, you know, publicity hound seeking fame.
Sure.
He was actually
not like one of the Wiener girls or something. He's somebody that
right.
doesn't seem as if he's interested in profiting himself from this.
Yeah, quite the contrary. He was terrified to even come forward and have possession of this thing.
To me, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Jen Kearns. You can hear her show All American Radio on a lot of great radio stations around the country. The latest of which is Talk Radio 790 KBC in Los Angeles. To me, Jennifer, the most interesting thing about this Hunter Biden story is the fact that big tech wasted no time in trying to keep people from learning about it. And I got the sense that after Twitter and Facebook prevented this story from being shared and actually went so far as to freeze or suspend Twitter accounts that were sharing this story, that all sorts of people started to pay attention to this story that previous to that instance had no interest in any of these Hunter Biden allegations.
Yeah, that's such a great point, Frank. And look, I don't know much in life. I'm not married, don't have kids. But I do know the American voter keenly well, and I do know the swing voter. And there's a very, very thin margin of them. 6% of the American electorate is undecided this year. Here's what they don't like. The independent swing voter, who is often the female voter, the suburban voter, the college-educated female voter, they like to read things for themselves. And when someone steps in and tries to keep them from reading such things, there's actually a backlash that occurs in that. And so I think big tech, i.e. Facebook and Twitter, have actually perhaps solidified the election for Donald Trump with their single act of trying to hide the Hunter Biden story. As you just alluded to, I agree with you. I think this Hunter Biden story would have been a one-day New York Post cover story of him allegedly, according to these photographs, passed out in the tub with a cigarette hanging from his lip. It would have been a 1 or 2 day story, and they could have moved on from it. But now the big tech interference, I think, becomes the central issue in the final 15 days of this election. I think it's going to favor Donald Trump incredibly. I'm hearing from groups of people all across the U.S., including, by the way, law enforcement groups that have contacted me over the weekend. They had 2.5 million followers on Facebook. All of their accounts got shut down over the weekend simply because they shared one link, and that was to the New York Post story. That has reverberations. That sends the chill up people's spine. It's the squelching of free speech, and they don't like it. And they don't like the party that's supporting it.
Final question on Hunter Biden, and then I want to pick your brain on one or two other items before we run out of time. Is, you know, there are some reports that Fox News was initially pitched this story and rejected it because they had some concerns about being able to vet it properly. And one of the reporters that was involved in the New York Post incarnation of this story actually went so far as to take his byline off of the story because he wasn't confident in some of the sourcing. Did those two instances give you any pause that maybe this story isn't the sort of smoking gun that Mayor Giuliani and others believe it to be?
No. And the reason for that, Frank, is just in the last 24 hours, the FBI has stepped forward with that chain of custody sheet saying that they did take in this laptop into their custody last December. And then you also have the storefront owner, his sources saying no, that he came to them some time ago and talked about this. And in fact, an employee at this Delaware computer repair shop actually tried to reach Hunter Biden to give the laptop back and said that Hunter Biden was intoxicated every time that he spoke with him. And eventually Hunter Biden had abandoned the laptop, and these people have apparently sworn to their statements. And so I do believe that the New York Post going this extra mile today to bring out those sources, I think was very smart on their part. Look, Fox News, sometimes they do shy away from stories, but that's the nature over at Fox. It's the speed of TV these days with the 24/7 news cycle. Sometimes the TV networks don't have the capacity to drill down deep into a story like this, whereas the print reporters do. And thank God for the New York Post. I mean, you know, they not only have the world's best covers and the funniest headlines on the cover every day, but they have the ability to really dig into some of these stories that the TV networks, just because of the warp speed that happens at the network. And I worked at Fox for 4 years. The networks just aren't able to tackle some of these longer, more in-depth stories.
All right. Let me ask you about the prospect of an aid deal. It seems like President Trump is willing to offer a deal that's even bigger than what Nancy Pelosi is asking for. The Senate Republicans seem pretty reluctant to go along with this. Do you think we'll actually see a COVID relief deal by the election? And what do you think the political beneficiary or beneficiaries will be of such a deal?
Well, look, time is ticking. There's 15 days left to the election. So this isn't like talking about some abstract thing if we were talking a month or two ago. I think it's likely that we have a COVID deal. But if we don't, the real people that will be suffering are the people who have portfolios on Wall Street. Wall Street seems to be very interested in making sure that people have cash in their pocket, especially heading into the holiday season where you have Black Friday sales and some of those things that usually buoy the American economy. So I'm not sure if a deal can get done. I think it's likely, but those who will suffer will probably be the big corporate guys who won't have that extra income, that disposable income from folks who are feeling a bit of a pinch after 6 months of lockdown in their business.
And then lastly, two groups of concern for the President Trump's reelection camp, if you believe what the analysts say, are seniors and Mormons. Mormons, which generally tend to vote Republican. Apparently, there's some real concern in states like Arizona, where there's a heavy Mormon population, that they're just not taking to President Trump. And we could actually see Biden win Arizona in part because of Donald Trump's lackluster showing with the Mormons. The senior poll numbers, that's causing some concern for pro-Trump folks in states like California, Arizona, and Nevada. Any thoughts at all about the polls in general and kind of the president's standing with either Mormons or seniors specifically?
Well, look, I would take the polls with a grain of salt at this point. Remember that on October 18th, 2016, this time 4 years ago, the polls had Hillary Clinton up by 18 points. Some of the networks even had her up in the 20% range. And so we know how those turned out not to be true, especially in those swing states that President Trump barnstormed in the last few days. You saw President Trump today hitting three cities in one day. He also had a great weekend in California over the weekend. There are three House seats in California alone that are looking like they might tip Republican. That's going to be a huge story on election night if that happens. But you also look, I think you could do some refining of talking points. And I think the Trump campaign is refining his talking points day by day, depending on what they're seeing in the polls. For seniors, the best argument against Biden is this: for the greatest generation that traveled overseas and left their homes and went to fight in a war to help freedom around the world, you're going to entrust Joe Biden, the guy who won't condemn Antifa, won't condemn the very violent protests at the hands of BLM. You're going to set the clock back on American freedom by electing Joe Biden. I just don't think that's possible. Look, I know seniors are nervous about the vaccine. They want it. They want to take it. I talked to my parents. They want to take it as well, just like they want to take the shingles vaccine. I mean, this is important to them. But look, I think the best point that Donald Trump can make, he's a senior himself. He's 74 years old. He had COVID, and he's living proof that you can be a senior and get COVID and live to fight another day and survive it. And I think that Trump campaign need to be punching up that point more and punching up the point about how Biden could ruin the next generation for these seniors' grandkids in the terms of freedom that likes we've never seen before in our generation.
All right, Jen, we're going to have to leave it there. Jen Kearns, check her out on KABC. She's pretty sharp, as you can tell. Jen, we'll chat before the election, I'm sure.
Sounds great, Frank. Take care.
Thank you. There was one other story that I wanted to bring to everyone's attention before we ran out of time. It is a Nassau story, not a Suffolk story, but worth mentioning nonetheless. A Nassau County park is being renamed in honor of an NYPD officer. Terrell Avenue Park in Oceanside, a place where I used to spend a lot of time when I was in the event videography business. I would videotape quite a few bar mitzvahs over at Oceanside Jewish Center and East Meadow Jewish Center when I was working for Lita Video. That's where a lot of our work was, those two catering halls. But anyway, Terrell Avenue Park in Oceanside is being rededicated as Detective Luis Alvarez Park. Now, Alvarez unfortunately died last year from cancer related to his work at Ground Zero. Before his death, he urged Congress to expand the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund, which they actually did end up doing. You know, he was one of the people that was out there with John Stewart lobbying for this and everything. And I think this is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I think it's a shame, of course, that this poor guy died because of his service to New York and to the country. But I think it's a nice thing for his legacy. You know, it's so funny. Sometimes my wife and I will be driving on the Belt Parkway and we'll see a name of somebody. Or we'll be driving somewhere and she'll say, we'll pass a name. What's Erskine Street? Or why is this street called this? Why is this highway called that? And you end up, I'll Google it because I don't always immediately know the answer. Sometimes I do. And those are the times I'm most proud of when I get to show off my knowledge of New York trivia. But anyway, I Google the people she asks me about and I learn about these folks. And it's a way that these folks get their legacy kept alive. And I think it's the same thing for Detective Alvarez. 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, hopefully, Long Island people will be walking by that park and look up who was Detective Luis Alvarez. And they'll see the things that he did. And I think they'll be similarly impressed that that was a pretty neat thing. Now, a couple of other stories I want to bring to your attention before we run out of time here. I still don't know what to make of this Jeffrey Toobin situation. I mean, I covered it at length this morning, and I don't have much of a desire to talk about it anymore. I'm not really one of these guys that likes to kick people when they're down. But, I mean, I do wonder. I mean, the guy is just so harsh towards Trump all the time. I do wonder, part of me wonders anyway, if there's an element of karma to this here. I don't know. The couple of times I've met the guy, the couple of times that I've talked to the guy, he's always been pretty nice to me. Even when I disagreed with what he was saying, I always found him to be a pretty intelligent guy and a pretty interesting guy to listen to. So I'm not one of these Trump supporters that's reveling in his demise here. In fact, if there's one thing that history of late has shown us, is that nobody is ever done. You're never done until you're done. You can always make a comeback. Now, it's what you do with that comeback that kind of defines you. Look at Anthony Weiner. The guy could be mayor right now. And he has now been forced to admit that his political career is probably over. But he had an opportunity to come back, and he squandered it by screwing up again. So everybody gets at least one mulligan, but you don't always get two, if you understand what I'm saying. We'll see what happens with Jeffrey Toobin. Now, a family boating in the Boston Harbor over the weekend happened upon a mysterious message in a bottle. I love stories like this. Love, love, love stories like this. Kim Boyd of Massachusetts was out on waters Sunday with her family when they spotted the barnacle-covered bottle floating around. The family brought the bottle home and used a hammer to crack it. Inside, they found the message, "Be safe, East Boston." Very interesting. A Minnesota man has claimed the first prize at the 47th Safeway World Championship Pumpkin Weigh-Off in California for his colossal-sized pumpkin. Travis Glenger, a landscape and horticulture teacher, grew a 2,350-pound pumpkin that beat the competition last week. He scored $16,450 for the lumpy gourd. Now, that's a guy that's going to get a commendation this week. I don't want to give you too much of a heads up on who's getting commendations this week, but I'm just seeing that story now. And if anybody deserves a commendation this week, I think it's Travis Glenger. Is it Ginger or Glenger? I'm going to say Glenger. I can't tell if that's an I or an L. You ever see that in the paper when you can't tell if it's an I or an L? That's exactly what I'm experiencing right now. I also am eager to see what happens with this homeless situation in New York City. I don't know if you followed this. We've had Randy Mastro on this program a number of times. Now, Randy Mastro is the attorney for some residents on the Upper West Side that want the homeless residents of the Lucerne Hotel on West 79th Street moved out of there. And he won a major victory when he got the city to agree to move them downtown. Now, the downtown people weren't so happy about that. But, you know, that's somebody else's problem. So yesterday, a court at the last minute, the day these homeless men were supposed to be moved, a court has stopped, at least for now, the relocation of these homeless people. So this is just the latest development in this brawl that's turned into just a huge problem for Mayor de Blasio and the local elected officials. So you have the opponents of these homeless people at the hotel, but they've hired Randy Mastro, who's a very high-powered attorney. He was a deputy mayor in the Rudy Giuliani administration. But you have these other West Siders, including other veterans of de Blasio's own administration who they want the homeless to stay. And you have a lot of local elected officials in that area that want the homeless to stay. So I don't know how this whole thing ends up, but it's going to be very interesting. And then finally, I got to bring this to your attention. 50 Cent. You know 50 Cent? I'm not that big of a 50 Cent fan. He's got a couple of hits that have a nice beat to it. You know, like that Go Shorty, It's Your Birthday. I think that's 50 Cent. So he tweeted a graphic from what looked like a CNBC broadcast citing studies that said high earners in New York City could face combined federal and state tax rates of 62% under Biden's plan. So he tweeted, what the F? Vote for Trump. I'm out. F New York. And then he added, the Knicks never win anyway. I don't care Trump doesn't like black people. 62%? Are you out of your effing mind? Words of wisdom from 50 Cent. Frank Morano. Good day.